Welcome to 1 hour of the toughest, roughest wrestling you'll ever see.
That's right, Dick the Bruiser, set it off.
The big question, have you got the endurance? Have you got the brains to get past the excellence of execution?
Where are all the gutless American wrestlers? Step in the ring with the Baron and face the brave.
The reason why Ax and myself were put on this earth is to demolish people.
Bobby Heenan, that is a very good-looking sport coat you've got on.
Yeah, and I paid for mine. Mine isn't government issue.
Yellow, everybody. Lance Russell and Dave Brown right along ringside. By golly, we're ready to go with another big week of championship wrestling.
Greetings and welcome to Wrestling Nostalgia. I'm your host, Dave Dynasty. We have a great episode for you today. It's a tribute to Mitsu Arakawa. We got Richard Vajcek on, who we're going to talk about Mitsu's career, and then primarily focusing on his work in the Midwest, because that's what Richard and I know the best. And then we're going to have Mitsu's eldest son, Michael Arakawa, on. And Mike and I are going to talk about Mitsu, a little about his career, but mostly about Mitsu as a man and as a father. So you get kind of both sides, a little insight into both sides of Mitsu. Mitsu is a very underappreciated talent in the history of professional wrestling. And Mike and I, we talk a little about why we think that is. I have very strong opinions why some of these guys get overlooked in some of these discussions. But Mitsu was a great, great worker, a great entertainer, a great professional wrestler, and by all accounts, just a great man. So I think he needs a little more attention, a little more discussion. Thus, I wanted to do this. He recently, would have been his birthday, was celebrated about a week ago. So it was the right time of year, I think, to pay tribute to Mitsu Arakawa. Although I think any time is the right time to pay tribute to him. So before we get into that, make sure you subscribe to the podcast and follow on social media. The podcast is available on all podcast platforms. Make sure whatever platform you listen to us, that you give us a rating and review. Share our episodes. Make sure you follow me on Twitter or X at The Dave Dynasty. That's where I post everything. I post lots of pictures, lots of historical dates, lots of cool stuff like that. And then, of course, I post the podcast episodes when they are released. Subscribe to my YouTube. It's at youtube.com/TheDaveDynasty. Once again, the podcast episodes are there, but there's lots of classic professional wrestling, particularly from the WWA on there. I'm always adding new stuff, so go check that out. Subscribe today. And if you want to financially support the show, the best way you could probably do that is to go buy a shirt at prowrestlingtees.com/TheDaveDynasty. And if you're looking for other podcasts to listen to, make sure you go check out the WrestleCopia family of shows. Wrestling Nostalgia is now a part of that family. I'm very excited, very proud, and very honored to be part of that group. So go check out all of their great shows with lots of great hosts and topics that shine a light on professional wrestling history. You can go to WrestleCopia.com or look up the shows on any podcast platform. And while you're out there, make sure you join the Wrestling Fans International Organization. Go to thewfia.org. And also make sure you join the WFIA Facebook group. Those are two separate things. You need to do them both, please. And check out the Ultimate Classic Wrestling Channel at classicwrestling.net. Or you can download the app on Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, iOS Mobile, and Android Mobile. Go sign up for a subscription. You will not be sorry. There's lots of great classic wrestling on there for you to partake in. So we're going to get right into it. Like I said, two great interviews here. Lots of great discussion and honoring and the legacy and the career and the man, Mitsu Arakawa. So let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll start off with Richard Vajcek and I talking about Mitsu's career. So stick around. This is Listen to Their Screams, a horror podcast that feels like you're chatting with friends. Hello, I am one of your friends, Dave. I am one of the co-hosts of Listen to Their Screams with my friend Ike, and we want you to come and check us out. We are a fun-filled, positive horror movie podcast that does reviews, news, birthdays, anniversaries. We play games. We are a ton of fun every week for you, the horror fan out there. For all of our links to our social media and the podcast platforms, just check out our link tree. It is linktr.ee/listen2screams. That is listen, the number two, and screams. Or look us up on your favorite social media platform and podcast provider. All right, and welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. I am Dave Dynasty. At this time, we're being joined by Richard Vajcic, author of the Bruiser biography. Richard, how are you?
Very good. Happy Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are looking at the career of Mitsu Arakawa, and particularly focusing in a lot on his Midwest time, which is what we're more, you know, Richard and I are most familiar with. But Richard, are we ready to walk through some of these highlights?
Yes. Dave, Mitsu was a significant contributor to old school wrestling for over 20 years. And he traveled to many different territories over those 20 plus years. I think he was one of the most prominent Japanese bad guys in the period after World War II in the United States.
Yeah.
And he achieved great title success with several different tag team partners in different territories. And I just want to credit the Cage Match website. You know, that's a source of a lot of the information, at least where I learned where he went. And then I could expand on my own knowledge.
Yep. Okay. Sounds good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, all points show that he started in Fred Kohler's territory in Chicago, and that was around 1954. And through 1961, he listened to all the places he went to. He went to NWA New Mexico. He went to NWA Minneapolis, the Stecker family. He went to NWA Amarillo, Funk Sr. He went to Winnipeg, Calgary, back to NWA Minneapolis, Omaha under the Dusick family, and then to Jim Barnett's promotion that was headquartered in Indianapolis, but included Detroit and Cincinnati. And he went to all those places in the first 7-8 years getting experience. I wanted to focus a little bit on Chicago because Cage Match shows that Mitsu appeared frequently on the Merry-Gold Garden shows and on the International Amphitheater shows promoted by Kohler. Now, Mitsu had a lot of experience appearing on the Dumont Network, which was a Saturday night nationwide telecast. And he did that for at least a full year before the national broadcast was canceled. In fact, Bruiser and Snyder can't even make that claim because they didn't get to Chicago until after that cancellation. But you gotta, give credit, you know, for Mitsu for being on a lot of those Merry-Gold Dumont programs.
Yeah, and appearing on the Dumont TV was, I mean, at that time in the 50s, that was a huge deal. I mean, that's where Vern Gagne and all those guys became national stars. So he would have, I mean, gained a lot of recognition from appearing on that program.
I can't prove it in court, but I would think the fact that out of the gate, he's on the Dumont Network, that helped him get those other gigs in the next 5 years.
Sure. Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
You know, and coupled with the, you know, the Japanese villain syndrome, which we had in wrestling. Now, I don't know right now if we had, you know, because now there's so many generations since Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. You know, I think most other generations have sort of never even experienced that. So, but anyway, that worked for him, didn't it?
Sure did.
And he goes to the Amarillo territory, and he used the title the Great Mitsu. And he, according to the cage match, how were these opponents he had? Dory Funk Sr., Mike DiBiase, John Tolis. That's not too bad very early in your career.
Sure.
And then
sure.
when he goes to Minneapolis after that, he teams for the first time with Kinshi Shibuya, who became one of his longstanding tag team partners, and they go together to Winnipeg, Calgary, Omaha, and to Barnett's territory in Indianapolis. You know, that was quite a territory. There's an internet photo floating around taken at a softball game in 1960, wrestlers versus the media. And it showed the stable of wrestlers that was with Barnett in 1960. It included Ellis, Snyder, Shibuya, Joe Blanchard, Bockwinkel, Roy Shire, Ray Stevens, the Brunetti brothers. Anyway, Mitsu and Shibuya were in that territory. You know, that's a very overlooked territory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I mean, that's some of the top names at the time.
I mean, when people that appeared in Detroit and Cincinnati and Indianapolis and those places, that was quite a run for Mitsu in those years.
Yeah.
And of course, in those days, unless you're a territory owner, you got to move on. And at the same time, one of his co-workers in Indianapolis, Roy Shire, decided to open up his own promotion in San Francisco, starting in 1961. And Mitsu was on the ground floor when Shire started that promotion. And many of his co-workers from Indianapolis migrated there too. Shire had quite a territory with cities such as Stockton, Sacramento, Oakland, Modesto, Fresno, Reno, Nevada. You know, that was known as a short trip territory. You know, you could in 2 to 3 hours, you could get anywhere and back, perhaps, the same night. And, of course, the culmination of that territory, the top venue was the Cow Palace in Daly City, California, which became one of the legendary wrestling venues in the United States. In fact, that's still there. It's not a lot of old-school wrestling venues are still up and running, but that one is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of the centerpiece there of the San Francisco territory.
Mm-hmm. I even think AEW did a show there. I think I saw that somewhere.
I think you're right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But Mitsu and Kinshi Shibuya won the World Tag Team titles of San Francisco. From Northern California, from the Brunetti brothers in November 1961, and held it for a year. And they defended that belt against the likes of Dax Calhoun and Red Bastien, the Nielsen brothers, and Ray Stevens and Don Minokian. Mitsu likewise got publicity in nationwide wrestling magazines. In the February 1962 issue of Wrestling Review, the story headline was, Mitsu has reason for being a killer. That was, I don't know, I don't know if that was before or after got into the business, maybe. But anyway, Mitsu, a year later with Kinji, they lost the tag titles to Wilbur and Nick Bockwinkel, which was an interesting combination at the time. You know, that both young in their younger in their careers. Later, Kinji and Mitsu challenged for the tag titles, who were later held by Jose Lothario and Pepper Gomez, and Ray Stevens and Pat Patterson, all for multiple matches. So they came in and out. It wasn't necessary completely staying there for years, but they bounced in and out and would come back. And I'm sure that was a pretty nice arrangement for them.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been interesting because Stevens and Patterson, you know, one of the great, great team. And
of all time.
Of all time. So that would have been, those matches would have been great.
Mm-hmm. Well, then Mitsu moved on to Minneapolis, Bern Gagne's territory in 1964. And he challenged Vern several times for the singles title. And in other matches, Mitsu faced the likes of Reggie Parks, Billy Red Cloud, Igor Vodic, Dale Lewis. He even challenged the AWA tag team champions, Larry Hennig and Harley Race, with another partner named Haru Sasaki.
Yeah, there, Hennig and Race, another top tag team of all time there that Mitsu's working.
Yeah, that's something, working main events with all these big teams that, the tag team, let me start again. The tag team world comes up big time in the next couple of years. For the first time, he works for Dick the Bruiser and Wilbur Snyder in Indianapolis. In October 1966, Mitsu wins the WWA heavyweight title from Bruiser. I think that speaks big time on the confidence.
Yeah, and I did. I talked to Mike Arakawa, who always said his dad was always Snyder so proud.
And Bruiser had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I talked to Mike. And we think. Oops, excuse me. I'm sorry, Richard. I spoke, I talked to Mike Arakawa, and he talked about how his dad was always so proud that he was given that chance to take the title from Bruiser. And it was always, such a point of pride in his career. And he always talked about it up till his death. So,
yes. I mean, Mitsu defended that title in Indianapolis against Ernie Ladd, the Crusher, against Wilbur, against Moose. He even faced Lou Thesz at Victory Field. In the summer, Bruiser and Snyder went outside to the minor league ballpark. So that would have been interesting. Thesz, who was no longer the NWA champion, but still, that would have been an interesting match, I think it would.
Yeah. I'd love anyway, to see. I wish there was footage of that.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, well, Mitsu, though, lost the WWA heavyweight title to Wilbur in September 1967. So it was close to a year holding that belt and held with pride. And I think it was a great run. Not everyone held the belt taking it from Bruiser or Snyder. Blackjack Lanza, Baron Von Raschke did, Ox Baker. You have to be a formidable performer with a good reputation and persona to do that. And Mitsu certainly did.
Yeah.
So the next thing, Mitsu formed a tag team with Dr. Moto, who wrestled in other circles as Tor Kamada. And Mitsu, during this, wrestled in both the WWA and the AWA. And I think it was unprecedented for one team to simultaneously hold two tag titles, and they accomplished that. It must have been a scheduling nightmare for Gagne and Bruiser. But, you know, you had, you know, a team that was hated. And how much of wrestling is you want to go see the bad guy get his? You know, and they won those WWA tag team belts from Bruiser and Crusher in October 1967. And on the AWA side, they won from Wilbur Snyder and Pat O'Connor in November 1967. So it was almost a full year. They wrestled both of those territories. That must have been, and they must have put a, I assume they did some airline flying at the time. But anyway, they lost the WWA titles to O'Connor and Snyder. This was in 68, followed by losing the AWA to Bruiser and Crusher. I remember hearing some of the interviews. You know, Crusher would use, you know, words, Japs. You probably couldn't do that now without getting cards and letters, but it was quite a heated thing.
Yeah.
So that was close to three full years working for Bruiser, and then the dual holding of the belts. And it was, of course, this happens a lot of times. When the Valiants, when their time is up at Indianapolis, where did they end up? When Blackjacks end their tag team run in the WWA, where do they end up? Where does Mitsu head to the WWW?
Yep. New York.
And of course, that's the territory that has big exposure in New York, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, D.C., Atlantic City, Boston, Baltimore. My educated guess, that was his best earning year in his wrestling career. And he was paired with Professor Taro Tanaka. This is the start off 1969. And the hook was the Rising Sun. So obviously in tag team competition, you need a championship. And according to the history of the WWE.com, I'll quote here, Tanaka and Arakawa won a fictitious tag team tournament in Japan to win the renamed WWF International Tag Team Championship. So, you know, they fought Bruno and Gorilla Monsoon. They took on the Sicilians, Lou Albano and Tony Altimore. In singles matches, he faced a young John L. Sullivan, who we would later know as Luscious Jack.
Yeah, Johnny Valiant. Yeah, obviously someone.
Johnny Valiant.
Someone we well know there from Indianapolis.
Yeah. Was on June 28, 1969 at Boston's Fenway Park. There was a 10-man battle royal. It included Mitsu, Baron Cicluna, Haystacks Calhoun, Albano, Luke Graham, Tony Altimore, and others. Mitsu won it, which, you know, that's just, you know, him being positioned for his run, which he already had the title. And that was a big card back then. The other two main events were Bruno versus Killer Kowalski in a stretcher match, and a cage match between Bulldog Brower and the Original Sheik. So Mitsu is right in the midst of that, the top of that card with those legendary wrestlers. Just by the way, just this week, I saw somebody, you know how some people on the internet sometimes post their souvenir programs?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Someone posted a Boston Garden program from 1969, October 4th. And the headline is Salt-Free Riot. And the stipulations, of course, Tanaka and Arakawa are facing Bruno and Antonio Pugliese. I'm half Italian. I should know how to say that, but I think that's it. But the stipulation is the Japanese team will be searched by the promoter and Arnold Skolin in the dressing room, so they don't have salt in it on them. And two refs also will search them in the ring. That was a very clever promotion.
Absolutely.
I thought, you know.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. Tanaka and Arakawa several months later would lose those titles to Victor Rivera and Tony Marino, ending a very respectable tag team run in the most populous territory in the country. And, you know, that, I guess that was his biggest money year. And you know what? Maybe we'll close out the talk today with his final run in the WWA for Bruiser. You know, I'm sure he felt loyalty to Bruiser and appreciated all the opportunities that Bruiser and Snyder gave him. And he gave good service to them, you know. A hard day's work for a hard day's wage, you know, as they say. Yeah. And he had a final run from 1973 to 75 with three different tag team partners. The first was Higo Hamaguchi, also known in Japan as Animal Hamaguchi, who in the 80s became a booker and executive in one of the Japanese promotions. There was another guy, another partner, the Great Saki. And they had a manager who I'm sure was talked about on your manager's program, Mark Manson.
Yep.
And then the final team was with Kim Duk from Korea. And of course, he later became known in the WWF as Tiger Chung Lee in the early 1980s. So that's where Mitsu he had almost parts of 3 years there. You know, we could have gone through a lot of other territories. You know, Mitsu went to Vancouver in the early 1960s. He went to Australia in the mid 1960s. In the 1970 to 71, he worked for the Sheik in Detroit. And his final territory was early 1976 for Nick Gulas. In Memphis, Nashville, that circuit. So I want to point out, too, to Mitsu's credit, the online World of Wrestling site points out that Mitsu had a big hand in helping Yoshito, Sato, Masahito, and Mr. Fuji to get start in the business. So when you come right down to it, though, you know, Mitsu was to old school wrestling. He went to all those different territories, had all those tag team trophies and belts held. And, you know, being a prominent Japanese wrestler after World War II, it was sure a credited career, you know? I'm interested to hear. You know, whatever else you do on this subject. And I guess the family has started a Facebook page.
Yeah, they have. And I, like I said, I have an interview also on this show with Mike Arakawa, his Mitsu's eldest son. And like I told him, man, Mitsu is so underappreciated and is probably, he's one of those guys that falls victim to the fact that, I mean, he had to retire around 79 because of a heart condition and some heart issues. And, He's one of those guys that kind of falls victim to having to hang it up before video became super prominent. And so there's not as much prime video of Mitsu out there as there are a lot of guys. You know, when people go on YouTube, you don't see as much prime Mitsu as you do guys from later. If he could have wrestled another 5 to 10 years, it might have been a completely different story.
I know there's one in color from around 1973, 74. It's Mitsu and Saki against Wilbur and Pepper.
Yeah.
And you know what, though? As generations go by, there's less people that had any exposure to Mitsu in person.
Yep. Absolutely.
So I'm just saying that's, you know, I mean, I'm sure that happens in the music business and, you know, any type of a live entertainment.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, I mean, yeah, film and anything. It's TV. It's all the same, right? It happens, but and that's you know, hopefully one of the things I wanted to do today is you know, shine a little light on Mitsu, maybe pique someone's interest enough to you know, go out there and research a little more, look up some more, see what they can find. Hopefully they'll go in and like the family's page for him and follow along with them. They post a lot of great family photos and stuff. And you know, like I said, I have a great interview coming up here in a bit, which is with Mike Arakawa, who talks a lot about, he talks a little about Mitsu's career, but talks a lot about, you know, Mitsu as a person and Mitsu as a dad. And that's, you get to see that side of it, which is pretty fascinating because,
yes,
along with being a great wrestler, Mitsu was a great guy. And from all accounts, and, you know, it was a bartender at the end of his life and late in his life and was loved by the community and different things like that. So, yeah. So,
well, I'm going to have to listen for that.
Yeah. It was a fun interview and Mike's a great guy. And like I said, hopefully people can, like I said, dive into Mitsu a little more and let's open a few eyes. So Richard, thank you for coming on.
Very good.
And talking about his career and the nuts and bolts of what he did in the ring. And everything. He did have a very accomplished career that a lot of people do not realize. And one of the top, you know, top attraction for, you know, whatever, 20 years, close to 20 years. Well, yeah, probably, you know, 15 to 20. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and it's just a very underappreciated. So thank you for coming on and chatting with me about that and helping shine some light on that.
Thanks again, Dave. See you soon.
Ladies and gentlemen, Wrestling Fans International Association is back. That's right, the premier fan club association of the 1970s and 1980s has been revived and is back in business. Join today. It's free at thewfia.org. That's thewfia.org. You can also join us on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/WFIA1969.
All right, and welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. This time we're being joined by Mike Arakawa, Mitsu's son. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing very good. Let's talk about your dad a little bit. Your father, of course, was an amazing wrestler, very underappreciated. But let's talk about his past a bit. According to his obituary, he was born in Japan and he moved to Hawaii at 3 years old, went to the University of Hawaii, served in the U.S. Army. Is all that accurate? What was your father's childhood like?
Okay, well, the part about being born in Japan is inaccurate. He was actually born in Hawaii.
Okay.
And he was, I can't remember the name of the small city that he was born in. It wasn't Honolulu. It was right outside of Honolulu. He was Nisei, which is second generation Japanese from, you know, Japan. So that makes me Sansei, third generation Japanese.
Okay.
So however many generations come out of Japan, that you count in Japanese that way. So, but he was born, and I don't know much about his school career. I do know that when he went to high school, now this is what he told me. He, Rocky Aoki of Benihana.
Yep.
He went to high school, I think, with Rocky. So he was friends with him. He was also friends with Harold Ajabsakura. Now this is before wrestling ever happened. Right. And yes, on the army career, he served in the military in the Philippines. It was between actually, he wasn't active. So it was, I think it was after Korea, before Vietnam, I believe.
Okay.
In that area. And he was in the Philippines. He was a staff sergeant, and he was in the medical corps.
Gotcha. Okay, well, and then from what it says after the Army, he moved to Chicago and looking for work. Was the work the reason for the move that drove him to go to Chicago? Or?
Yes, there was work. A friend of his, I believe, he was he moved to Chicago, and I'm thinking it was some type of manufacturing that he started out in, but that's actually where he started wrestling. Because a friend of his got him to go to try out, I guess. And I believe it was Dick Ophelis that actually hired him way back then. I mean, but you know, that's, you're talking way before I was born, so I can't be completely accurate about this.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, everything says that, yeah, you know, he moved to Chicago. That's where, you know, he started training, he started wrestling. Now, of course, Chicago was always been a hotbed professional wrestling, but especially in that time. It was on the DeMont Network, one of the, it was like the central hub of wrestling.
Golden Age, right?
Yeah, that's right. But, and of course,
you know,
go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say something real quick.
Yeah.
And I still, to this day, don't believe my mother. My mother told me that he was actually married before he married my mother. It was a lady that he met in Chicago, and he got married, and he was not with her for a long time, and there were no children. They had a dog. That's all I know. That's all I know about that whole relationship. And then married my mom when he met her in Indianapolis when she worked at the old Holiday Inn on West 16th Street. It turned into the Classic. It was right across the street from the track.
Yeah.
So that's where he met my mom when he was in Indianapolis wrestling. So, and you know, then that's how the story starts. Well, the Hall family.
Yeah, well, and that was customary during that time, right? Your dad, he was portrayed as a foreign adversary, right? A foreign villain.
Absolutely. Yeah, he was a heel.
Yeah, did that ever make life difficult for your dad or for you as kids in the day-to-day life?
He was really protective of us. The only thing I remember, sometimes we'd go to the store and kids would ridicule him and, you know, say, oh, he's a bad guy and stuff like that. They never really attack his being Japanese. But I'm sure you might know in that time period, I believe that, and this is coming from my mom as well, that they had to go to Georgia to get married. They weren't allowing that type of marriage in Indiana. So that's where they went to get married. But I can only remember one time in the Safeway supermarket where two kids tried to make fun of him, and he jokingly chased them down one of the aisles, and they ran like it was pretty funny, to be honest. But they didn't show their face, and he didn't mean to hurt them or anything. He's just
Well, what about going to school? Did your classmates know who your dad was?
Yeah, they knew who he was, and they admired him. They really liked him, and I got no problems from that. In fact, I used to take signed autographed pictures to school and hand them out to my friends, and they really liked that. All the way through high school, actually, I'd give them signed autographed pictures.
Yeah, I gotta imagine, you know, young boys especially, it'd be pretty cool if you had a classmate whose dad was a professional wrestler that they watched on TV. I mean,
it was quite something growing up. And then they'd always ask, how's it like having him as a father? I said, scary. I used to tell them, you know, how would you like it if and my father had this look about him. He was very, very soft spoken, very silent. If he was upset with you for any reason, if you entered the living room and you walked across it and his eyes just kind of met you and followed you across the living room, you'd kind of speed up your walk at the end of it and try to get out of it as quick as possible.
Were you ever fearful that he was going to throw the salt at you?
No. Yeah, I just let me tell you a little story about that.
Yeah.
Everyone thought that it was this very special Japanese imported blessed salt. It was 100% iodized Morton salt that he kept in his suitcase.
Oh, man, you just broke the myth.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. Right. I'm sorry.
So what you mentioned, right? It was a little scary, but what was he like as a father? I mean, right? All of us, you know, saw, you know, Mitsu, and fans saw Mitsu as, right, this wrestler, this heel, this scary guy. But to you, he was dad, right? What was that like? It's peculiar to us who are not in that situation to think that that you just view him as we view our dads, right? No different. And it's a.
And I have to kind of echo Justin Race. I listened to that interview, and just like Harley was just dad to Justin, that's what Pop was to us. I mean, he was just Pop. I mean, on the weekends, sometimes if he didn't have to wrestle, on a Monday, we'd go fishing sometimes. You know, he'd like to go fishing. He'd like to go bowling. By the way, there's an interesting story about bowling, too. We used to go with Jim Raschke. You know, the Baron.
Baron, yeah.
And he had a custom made 22-pound bowling ball. And when he bowled, it sounded like thunder. And then when it hit, especially if I got a strike, it sounded like he broke the pins. But it was awful fun going with him and Bonnie and his kids. And then we went. If it wasn't bowling, it was fishing out at Isaac's Lake. Old Isaac, I just remember his name was Isaac, and that's where we'd fish. I can't think. Then I played baseball, Little League baseball. He would be. He actually coached 1 year. Helped coach.
Wow.
He was like an ordinary dad. There was some issues where he would be he would be very expectant, of certain things, and
right.
You really tried hard to maintain them, and if not, you felt like you didn't what's the word? I just wanted to live to his expectations is what I'm trying to say, I guess.
Yeah, and you talk a lot about, you comment a lot on things where some of these wrestlers, right? You grew up around them, and a lot of them were almost like uncles and such to you.
I'm sure Justin, I remember Justin saying something about this. The cookouts were ridiculous. We would have cookouts in our backyard. We used to live on Ashway Drive, right off High School Road, in real close to Eagledale, I guess it is, if I remember. It's 34th and High School. Anyway, that's right around the time when he had, Higo Hamaguchi was probably one of his partners. And then the professor would come over, Toru, Charlie. Mm-hmm. We call him Charlie. His name is Charlie Kalani. Or was, the professor and Dr. Moto. All of them. The last one that was probably at our house would have been Kenji, probably. Kenji Shibuya. Kenji lived in California when we did as well in later years. But we'd have cookouts, and Bobby Heenan would be there. Jim Raschke would be there. Dick Ophelos would come over. I think Pepper Gomez came over a couple times. I don't remember Wilbur Snyder being there, but I do remember, a lot of the wrestlers. And then in later years, when he retired from wrestling, well, we can get to that later if you want, when we talk about
we'll get there.
But yeah, cookouts at the Yin Yang, and my father was always expected to make his famous teriyaki. Okay. Teriyaki steak, teriyaki kebabs, teriyaki chicken, and rice pilaf. And there's a big argument between my mother and my father back then about who came up with the pilaf recipe. It was something, really.
Yeah. So, I mean, what was it like? Did you grow up around some of the kids? Right. You talked about Vernon Rescue, right? He has a son named Carl, and yeah. Bobby Heenan has daughters.
Carl and Heidi.
Yeah.
Yeah. We knew their kids. We knew. Let's see, who else? I can't remember Charlie's son's name, but he had two sons, but they lived in Jersey. So they, you know, they'd only come over on a cookout when they were in town. Let's see. I can't remember. You know, Jim's kids were really the only kids that we grew up with, I think. When we got older, that's when I, you know, that's when I met more of them. Mm-hmm. I wish I would have met Justin, but you know, I didn't get a chance to meet him. I'm older than he is, so
yeah.
So I would have been. I think I'm at least 10 years older than he is. So
yeah. So did you go? I mean, did you go to the matches and the shows, or did they try to?
Oh gosh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I used to go to the matches at the at Busch Stadium, at the Armory, at the Coliseum. And then I'd travel with Pop sometimes. I remember one specific trip where I went to Canada with him, and it was with Jim Rashke, Bobby Heenan, Mark Manson.
Yeah.
Remember when Manson was a manager?
Yeah. Man, what a bumper. Oh.
Yeah. And we'd go there. We flew to from Michigan or Minnesota. I can't remember where we flew from, but we went to Canada. I wish I would have went to Australia with him, but I didn't get a chance to go with him there. And then he went to Japan. I went to Japan in many later years, and they thought I was my father, even being that older, you know, that much older. I went with, you know, Dick Beyer, the Destroyer.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, I went there with Dick Beyer, and it was quite a trip. We were there on business, and Dick opened up some doors for us, basically, you know, being as popular as he was in Japan.
Yeah.
So yeah, but I went to a lot of the matches.
Yeah.
A lot of them.
So let me understand. So what you said earlier, so your dad was the first generation of your family to be born in America, right? Outside of Japan. Is that what you were saying?
Yes. His parents were born in Japan.
Right.
So
okay.
he and his siblings were born in Hawaii.
Okay. So what, when you trace back your family then, you know, to your grandparents, what part of Japan are they from?
Southern Japan. That's all I can tell you. I can also tell you that Arakawa, translated means rough river. So that could even mean or say that we were from a fishing class family, but I also know that we served in the Ina clan, which also served the shogun, the last shogun of Japan. So we were right up there. I mean, maybe not first class samurai, but you know, right in there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, you know, your father, I mean, like I said, he's underappreciated. He had a great career, right? Several titles, tag singles, was a star draw, especially in the Midwest.
Yes.
But when you did, as a kid, did you know how big a star your dad was there in the Midwest? I mean, did it dawn on you?
Yes. Yeah. As I got older, not when I was, now, unfortunately, when I was seven, you know, we were very young when my father and mother split up. So that was a hard time, but we still maintained a strong relationship with him. You know, we would, that's when he actually was, right around the time when he retired from wrestling, right around the late 70s.
Yeah. That was my next question, right? He retired around 79, but because of a heart condition, is that correct?
Yeah. Well, not just heart. He had several, medical conditions, heart, diabetes, things like that. And he didn't pass physical one night, and the doctor wrote him off. He said, nope, you're not going back in the ring until you, you know, take care of your, you know, take care of some health issues. And he decided that that was it. I didn't even think that, I don't even know if he was asked or prompted to go into managing or not, you know, like Mr. Mm-hmm. Fuji. But by the way, my father helped train Mr. Fuji. My father was known for that. He was that's why when I if you remember when I tried to when I contacted you a few months ago about maybe trying to get my father in the Hall of Fame for the you know Dick's the WWE, it's the WWA, right? That's who he, and because not because of my father being a popular and famous wrestler, but because of all the help he did to the Japanese wrestlers that came after he did. He was really looked up to, and then whenever he went to Japan, they bowed to they showed respect to him like he was a mentor, and that really made me feel very proud. It really did. I mean, aside from the wrestling, knowing that Pop was looked upon that way.
Yeah, but I mean,
right around 79. Like you said, right around 79 is when he retired, and that's when he Joe Habush was the owner of the Pizza Inn on Lafayette Road, which became Papa Joe's.
Yep.
And they were very good friends, and he became bar manager. Not only became the bar manager for Papa Joe's, but he also lived with Joe Habush in the house on Kessler Boulevard. Well, Dick Ophelos lived on Kessler Boulevard.
Sure did.
Too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There was a couple wrestlers actually.
Yeah.
Like Wrestler's Lane or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And of course, yeah, of course we're talking. So, yeah, we're talking about in Indianapolis there. So how
absolutely.
Was that? How was that transition for Mitzi? Did he? Was it hard for him to give up the wrestling?
You know what? I don't think it was as hard as it would be for some of the other wrestlers. I mean, he didn't really, you know what? And I didn't really get a chance to really talk to him about it. He didn't really mention it. He seemed happy all the time. And he liked working at the bar. He hated making pina coladas, but, but, and you know, especially around the time that song came out, If You Love Pina
Oh,
Coladas.
Yeah.
Oh gosh. They used to play that all the time at the bar. And they did that just to make him upset.
Just so you know,
all the waitresses loved him. And
just so you know,
Papa Joe's became the wrestler hangout.
Yeah. Just so you know, I hate that song. The Pina Colada song. Oh, I hate that song.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Oh, I hate it.
Rupert Holmes, right? Is that his name?
Yeah, yeah. God, I don't know what it is. I do not like that song. like you said, I mean, as much as Mitsu excelled as a wrestler and in that word, I mean, he managing Papa Joe's, he did too, right? I mean, people loved him, right? He was a pillar
there,
of the community.
They came in there to talk to him. They came in there to meet him. If you weren't his friend, which most of them were. You played golf with them. They played golf at Riverside with Dick Minor out there at Riverside, and they used to that Papa Joe Hubbish used to play. There were several players that used to just come in there and hang out at the bar. But when the matches came in, and at that time they were wrestling in Market Square Arena, that's where I met Andre the Giant for the first time. He came into the bar. This is a funny story. Okay, you know, Andre had a reputation for drinking. Beer, wine, whatever. French, you know, so he loves his wine. So he sat in the bar at Papa Joe's and drank wine and continually drank wine, closed the place down, and didn't leave the restaurant till like 4 o'clock in the morning. Joe was in the office. He couldn't do anything. How are you going to throw out Andre the Giant? So he sat there and drank, I don't know, something like a case and a half of wine on his own. And so it was pretty funny, actually. But I shook hands with Andre, and I swear, when his hand like enveloped mine, his fingers wrapped around my wrist. That's how big this guy's hand was.
Yeah.
He was just phenomenal.
Yeah.
But, all the wrestlers used to come there. That's where I had dinner with Harley Race after he took the strap from Bobo Brazil. I can't remember, but there's you have a posting of that.
I do.
But I absolutely remember that. We were sitting there. My father came out from the bar, and he I remember his words to this day. I took the strap from Bobo tonight. That's what he told my father.
Yeah, I know Scott Roberts posted several times about playing golf with your dad and stuff like that and different things. Uh-huh. And so your dad, I mean, even though he wasn't wrestling anymore, he was still in touch with these guys.
Oh, gosh,
still in contact. And everything else. And there was, I mean, I know there was an article in one of the Indianapolis papers even about Mitsu when he managed the Papa Joe's about, you know, this former wrestler who's loved by his patrons and his community.
I've got that news article on my wall.
Yeah. And it was,
a picture of him behind the bar, right?
Right. Yeah. Shows him like, yeah. He's like kind of wiping the bar or something. Yeah. He's behind the bar. Yeah. But it focuses on him managing Papa Joe's and being a former wrestler. But it talks about how much everybody that comes in the bar there and everybody loves Mitsu.
Absolutely. If I remember, there was a couple interviews. There was one where they took a picture of me, and it was a picture of my father telling me what to do on the grill. And this is when I first got my start in food, was at Papa Joe's, and I became a professional chef. A lot of my friends asked me, why didn't you follow your father's footsteps? You know, in fact, when I worked at Long John Silver's, Jimmy and Johnny Valiant tried to get me to, trying to talk me in to following Pop's footsteps. They wanted me to go in the ring. They said they would pay for the training and everything. I mean, they really wanted me to do it. And guess who? Just like Justin, my parents said no. You know, I remember Justin saying to you that Harley and his wife, Justin's mom said, nope, you're not doing it.
Yeah,
and just like him, my father and my mother said no. So I had to honor my father's wishes. You know, I don't know what would have happened, but I don't even know how. I mean, I've practiced martial arts all my life, but can't really use that in wrestling. You know? So,
yeah. Well, anyway. Then your dad he moved to California. So what prompted that move? What was that? Was that family driven?
Actually, I was the first one to move out in 1988, I took a job at Neptune's Palace at Pier 39 in San Francisco. One of my chef mentors invited me out to work with them. And when I moved, the rest of the family moved. I moved first, then my mother, then my father, then my brother and sister came out. Everybody moved out. And we all settled in the same apartment complex. And unfortunately, that's where my father passed away, was in that apartment complex. It was a year after my little boy passed away. I had a son that only lived for 4 hours. And a year after that is when Pop passed away.
What was the cause of death with Mitsu? What happened?
It was a congestive heart failure.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so I mean, it got to the point where he had a good doctor and everything. It's just it just got past the point of healing, it's too bad. He didn't make his 70th birthday. But then again, my mother's mother didn't make her 70th birthday either.
Yeah.
So. My mom is, she's going to be 82. So she's kicking right along.
Well, you know, you, like you said, you talked about your father as a trainer and everything, but man, your father had an outstanding career. And then he's one of those guys that falls victim to the time period, right? Because like we said, he had to retire around 79, which is right before a lot of video and stuff started, right?
That's absolutely when, right before it really started kicking in. Like I remember the Turner Broadcasting Network Tommy Wildfire Rich you know, those guys. And then right after that, then you had Hulk Hogan. And actually, Hulk used to come in the bar too. And Pop used to call me a little youngster. He is like much bigger than my father, Hulk was, but that's what he called me, a little youngster.
Yeah, but I mean, Your father was a huge star in Chicago and Indianapolis, but unfortunately, there's not as much video of that time because they reused tapes or things got destroyed. So people aren't as aware of some of these wrestlers that are kind of lost of time. But that's not to say that you can't hold your father's career up to the guys after him, because your father, I mean, not only in Indianapolis, right? I mean, he was all over, right? He wrestled in the Southwest
California. I was born in California, and that's where he was wrestling. In fact, remember the Bernetti brothers?
I do. Yeah, yeah.
Guy Bernetti is either my godfather or my sister's godffather. I can't remember who, but we were very close with them. They just came out with a movie called Iron Claw about the Von Erichs.
Yep, absolutely.
My father was very good friends with Fritz. I mean, they were very good friends. The kids, all of them, my mother used to say that she used to bounce Carrie on her knee and babysit them. I mean, she used to babysit the Von Erichs. So, I know they live in Texas, or that's where they actually settled or whatever.
Yeah.
But whatever this time period my mom's talking about, they lived close. Okay. So,
yeah.
Anyway, and then Kenji Shibuya lived out in California. Who else? There was a lot of people. You know what? The thing that upsets me is my father's in California wrestling the same time Bruce Lee opened up his studio. I really wish that we would have been able to meet Bruce Lee. I know I was just a kid, a real young kid, but I just wish I would have met him.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah, but like I said, it's you know, that there's, you know, several guys that do get lost because of the lack of video, because so many people they look on YouTube, and that's where they form their vision of history.
Well, and if they're the big guys, like Bruno Sammartino and Vern Gagne, you know, the AWA and one of them had one circuit, one had the other, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Out the east. So I'm not sure who had what, but you're talking about, and then Luthez.
Yep.
You're talking about people that, I mean, I know they're obviously, they have to be in the Hall of Fame. They have
sure.
to.
Sure. Yeah.
So I was just hoping, you know, that since my father was who he was, and, for some reason, and I don't know what it is, a Japanese wrestler will be remembered more easily than say if you ask who Mitsuo Arakawa was, and then you say who's Bob Backlund, a lot of times they'll remember my father, but I know who Bob Backlund is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, I know some of these wrestlers, and they're past famous. They're, you know,
mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable. Bobo Brazil. I sat and ate popcorn with Bobo Brazil in the dugout at Busch Stadium. I mean, it was just wonderful. Just wonderful growing up around this.
Yeah. Well, I have a handful of guys that's what I feel, right? I like to support and try to help as best I can to keep their name alive and fight things, right? You know, and one of my big projects is Cowboy Bob Ellis, man, because I cannot believe.
Oh, gosh. Cowboy Bob Ellis was a great individual. He really, I remember the war that he had with Jim Raschke. I remember that feud they had. But Bob was a very outstanding individual. I still remember how he used to take his hat off every time he'd greet the, you know, the fans when he was introduced. And there's just a lot. You're right. I noticed that one post you did on this on your very last podcast, it has five or six people at the same time.
Yep.
I gotta be honest, and I'm almost ashamed, I only know maybe two of those people, and that's terrible.
Yeah, well, those are those guys were more into the 80s, but they were back right at the tail end, right, of when right before WWE kind of became everything. Right. And they were kind of lost in that shuffle. But the thing is, those guys are so talented, but they get overlooked because of the time period and right where they fall.
Absolutely.
And there are so many guys that that get lost in things because of that. And but again, one of your, you know, one of the guys that I always hold that I think needs more recognition and should be talked about much more in the course of wrestling history is your father, Mitsu Arakawa, because people don't, they don't understand, because there's not a whole lot of footage out there of him. People don't understand the impact he had on wrestling and how good he was and how in demand he was and how he worked everywhere and how he was a draw everywhere. And so therefore, you know, because people can't see it on YouTube, they act like, you know, they act like it doesn't exist. And, you know, and I think, you know, that's, you know, part of the reason that I'm always, you know, sharing stuff with him. Part of the reason I want to do this.
Yeah. I really appreciate all the work you're doing, Dave. It's an honor to sit here and talk to you. And the work that you do is, I mean, if there's anything I can do to help, I would certainly do it. I mean, you're absolutely right about some of these wrestlers that, you know, I mean, how many people know who, you know, Prince Pullins is or
absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, when I was in California, I had two hotels right before I moved back to Indiana. And my very last guest that I knew was Ted DiBiase and Tony Atlas.
Yeah.
And they were both dinner guests in my restaurant. And this was back when I guess Ted DiBiase actually became a minister. And was preaching, and he would do shows for the church, but he would incorporate wrestling. Like I think in California when he was staying at my hotel, Tony was playing the devil, and Ted DiBiase was playing the priest, and he was going to throw Tony out of the ring, and I can't remember how it was going to go, but. But I have excellent memories of some of these people that, and they're just great.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And again, in the overall scheme, right? Your dad's career got cut a little shorter than what it probably should have been. And and unfortunately, I think that again that helped, that hurt his exposure, right? Because it was just the wrong time for it to end. But again, like I said, this is as we are recorded. We're recording on the 22nd of May. This is the day before what would have been his birthday. And
tomorrow is his birthday. Let's see. He was born at 27. So what's that?
oh my
gosh.
Nine. Ooh, I don't know. What did you say? 27? So it would have been
97 years old.
97. Yeah. So, wow. And again, you know, this will come out a little after his birthday, obviously, but, you know, that's what triggered me to think, hey, this is a good time to do it right
around. Yeah, well, that's my fault. I apologize again for missing.
No, it's okay. Yeah, that's okay. No, I mean, it happens, right? You know, it's hard to schedule people with their, you know, things going on and everything else. And again, also in this podcast, I'll be talking to Richard Vycheck. We'll be talking more the nuts and bolts of his career and those things. And I wanted to talk to you though, because you give us that personal side, right? To get to see Mitsu more, right? As dad, as a person, but you know, in that unique perspective, which is important too. But again, like I said, I have a handful of guys that I try and I work hard to try to shine a little light on when I can. And Mitsu's definitely one of those guys that I'm always plugging away. And I think deserves more recognition, deserves more props. And hopefully, you know, hopefully someone will hear this and, you know, maybe dig a little deeper and what
I really appreciate the work. You know, if you're going to be doing anything on any of his partners?
Maybe. I mean, yeah, there's nothing, you know, set in the plans, but I'm always coming up with something. Yeah, there's a distinct possibility. Yeah, in the future that may come about.
They were actually all of them are good people. I swear.
Yeah.
I think his last partner that I remember was Kim Duck.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Mitsu had a lot of great tag team partners, right? I mean, he was great tag teams. Is there a way, if anybody wanted to keep track of anything going on with the family, is there a way to do that? Do you have any form, not that I know of, but is there any form of kind of official social media or anything out there for Mitsu or the family or anything, or
not the career You mean for my father's career or the Arakawa family?
Yeah, well, yeah, primarily with your father. I think maybe that's something you and I, maybe we ought to discuss that off interview of maybe, you know.
I'll tell you why. I would set up a page for my father if I thought I could. If I thought I had enough material to, you know, and.
I think that could happen. I think you need something like that where people can go and have a central place, right, where they can go and look at some of these memories and these pictures and different things about your father. And then if anything, you know, things like this or anything develops in the future where Mitsu's brought up, where they can go and they can see that stuff, right? Where they can hear about it in one location. So, you know, like whether it be a Facebook page or something like that.
That would be great.
Yeah. Well, I think you and I will talk about that. And okay. we'll keep the listeners posted on that, because I think
that sounds great. We can definitely start it out on my Facebook page. I'm not really on any other social media, but I certainly would go to one, you know, an Instagram account and all that.
Yeah, I think it would be I think that would be a good thing to help this crusade to shine a little light on your father. So we'll talk about that outside of this. But let's talk, I mean, just briefly here before we get off here. I mean, you're a chef, right? Talk to us about that. How did that become a passion of yours?
Unfortunately, I'm a disabled chef now, I was making lasagnas at Papa Joe's when I was like 12. and then from there, I did a little fast food stint with Long John Silver's. Worked with the Merritt's family of Merritt's Pizza World and all that for a little bit. Then I started in the hotels, went to the Holiday Inn Airport and the Country Club of Indianapolis. And then after that, that's when I went to California for 11 years. I needed California on my resume if anyone was going to take me serious. So I worked in San Francisco for a few years and then Palo Alto, Gordon Biersch Brewery Restaurant, Jack London Village, Shenanigans for that restaurant company. I can't remember. American Restaurant Group, I think it was. And then Neptune's Palace is owned by Pier Restaurants, which was owned by Pier 39. And then I came back and worked for Papa Joe's in Avon. George Habush, Joe Habush's youngest son, opened up a restaurant in Avon, and I worked for him for a few years. And then that's when I went to IU, and I worked for IU for 13 years. That's so after IU, I went to community in Anderson, and that's where I injured my back. Further than it was already injured. So, yeah, my doctor ended up disabling me. I'm trying to make it back, but I think my chef days are over.
Yeah.
Because of my age and things like that.
Yeah. And yeah, you said this was kind of a passion. I mean, your dad, right, had a passion for cooking, you said, right? Because of the.
Oh, gosh, yes. But when he saw how I could cook in California, he absolutely loved it. He wanted me to teach him. I said, Pop, you're the one that taught me how to make teriyaki. I mean, you know, just because. I can make shrimp a certain way, you know, I was making it, you know, Vietnamese style or whatever. He definitely had a passion for food. And he had a palate for it too. I mean, and then the wine to go along with it.
Yeah. Well, Mike, thanks for joining us and talking to us about your dad. Like I said, I wanted to do a little something
it's an honor. Thank you for having me.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Whatever time you're listening to this, wherever you are listening to this, this is Greg Klein's Old School Wrestling Talk in, well, ad form? Hi, everybody. My name is Greg Klein. I'm a former professional wrestler. I was trained by Adrian Street in the Skull Crusher Shed in Gulf Breeze, Florida, and then later mentored by Golden Boy Jerry Gray at state fairs across the country. And later, I was an actor who was on 24. Currently the film commissioner for Otsego County, New York, which includes Cooperstown and the Baseball Hall of Fame. I'm also trying to produce a movie, and I've got a lot of fun stories about working at the Sharper Image in Beverly Hills, California that I throw in as well. Like everybody else, I've got a podcast, And mostly I talk about the things that I love, which is old school territory wrestling, especially Southern wrestling, especially Texas wrestling. And I think I've got maybe one of the most extensive collections of Houston wrestling programs in the world. So I pull them out all the time to talk about old school angles. I'm working on getting Morris Siegel and the Junkyard Dog into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. So if you're a voter, please check in with me and look at my papers. And I'd love it if you guys would check out my podcast, because I need a few more fans and a few more exotic places. We're heard everywhere from Frankfurt, Germany, to Houston, Texas, to Cooperstown, New York, and in between. So please check us out at Greg Klein's Old School Wrestling Talk, every place that you get your wrestling talk. And follow me on Twitter at JYDBook.
All right, and welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. Special thanks to Richard Vicek and Mike Arakawa for coming on and helping me pay tribute to Mitsu Arakawa. It was great the conversations, great talking to both those guys. And hopefully, you know, if you don't know who Mitsu is or are not familiar with him, hopefully that helps shine some light and expose what a great worker he was, what a great man he was, and kind of give you a full look at the incomplete person, right? The worker and the man. And give you a little insight into Mitsu Arakawa. Hopefully that will make you want to go out, dig a little deeper, do some research of your own, look up some of his results, some newspaper articles, different things on him, and check him out, because Mitsu definitely deserves a little more attention, a little more discussion, and so hopefully we shined a little light on his career. Make sure you go follow me on X at the Dave Dynasty. Like I said, go check out all the WrestleCopia Network podcasts. Go on any of your podcast platforms, look up WrestleCopia, they'll all come up. And, you know, and then, like I said, check out the WFIA, check out the Ultimate Classic Wrestling Channel. We got lots of cool stuff going on out there for us classic wrestling fans, us nostalgic wrestling fans, as I like to call myself, fans of wrestling history. There's lots and lots and lots going on, and hopefully part of that is Wrestling Nostalgia Podcast. Hope you enjoy what we give you. And what we provide for you. We got lots of cool stuff coming up in the future. We have interviews with Rex Bode. We have interviews with Wendell Cooley. An interview with John Tatum coming up. Joel Goodhart, Ed Helensky coming up. And, of course, we have the deep dives into the AWA that will be coming up in the very near future, starting with May 1988. Lots of great stuff coming up on the Wrestling Nostalgia Podcast. And I got lots of other guys that I'm talking to that I'm getting ready to do interviews with. So lots of great, great stuff to give you that wrestling history, to scratch your wrestling history itch. So make sure you subscribe to me on Twitter, add me on Facebook, or follow me on Facebook. And you can see I announced the following week's episode, or that the current week, I announced the week's episode and guest on Sunday. So make sure you follow me, and each Sunday you can see what's coming up on that week's episode. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for your support. Thank you for all you do to make this so much fun and so enjoyable. And I love sharing this stuff with you. I love our discussions online. You guys are truly a treat, some great followers and listeners, and I am truly appreciative. So until next episode, wherever you go, whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep on growing.
Fans, we brought you All-Star Championship Wrestling. This is Sam Menaker thanking you for being with us and saying until next time, so long, everyone.